It's a pleasure to introduce our next instructor here at Best Ideas 2018, joining us from Manhattan Beach, California. Matthew Peterson is the managing partner of Peterson Capital Management. We are very proud that Matthew brings well over a decade of industry experience to the summit. Prior to founding Peterson Capital Management, Matthew split his time between Wall Street and London as capital markets manager in the financial services vertical at Diamond Management and Technology Consultants. A very warm welcome, and thank you for choosing to directly share your wisdom with the MOI global community. We are honored to have you here with us, Matt. Please proceed.
Thank you, Shai. It's a pleasure to be here as well. I think I've been a member of the MOI community now for many years, and I've shared with a lot of people that it is certainly one of the top financial newsletters in the world. So it's a pleasure to be back, and I always appreciate the invitations. As you mentioned, Shai, I run Peterson Capital Management and Peterson Investment Funds. We launched in 2011, and we run a long-term value-based portfolio that's relatively concentrated with generally about 10 to 15 holdings. We've returned about 140% net to LPs, which is approximately 15% annualized. And one of the unique aspects of our firm is that we do regularly utilize some structured products to obtain some lower or better prices for the securities that we acquire. Let's kind of jump into a few of the slides here. Slide two is a little message from the compliance group, and three shows the agenda for today. Today, markets are up some 400% since the depths of the financial crisis, and the herd mentality is really of a risk-taking nature at this point. And that is why this idea is a little different. In the presentation here, I'm going to attempt to show a portfolio hedging opportunity that has become very inexpensive. And I think for many of the folks in the audience who have a mandate to include something like this in their portfolio, they may really appreciate understanding and utilizing something along these lines. So I'll start here by talking a little bit about how I'm looking at the current state of the markets. Then we'll go into analysis on the current volatility of the markets. I will jump pretty quickly into the actual opportunity, this hedge opportunity. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about how we might think about sizing a position like this. And then, of course, discuss some risks and considerations. So with that, let's take a look at some of the unique aspects of this market. It is essential to consider the psychology of market participants when you're allocating capital. And today, market and Wall Street and Main Street participants alike are extremely euphoric. I think we see significant risk-taking behavior, and we see a lot less risk avoidance. So let's look at a few things that we know and look at how unique these are on an individual level, and then in combination, what a rare situation we may be in. We have global markets many global markets are at an all-time high. The S&P 500 here is approaching 2,700. Interest rates, of course, have for now many years been artificially low. In the U.S. today, the 10 years are still at 2.3%. Indicators that are watched by many in the value community, like the Shiller PE ratio, is at the second highest rate ever recorded at 32. The Buffett value indicator, which is basically market capitalization, equity market capitalization divided by GDP, is at the highest level since 2000. It's now up to 140%. And for those who recall, in 2001, Warren Buffett penned a Forbes article, I believe, where he indicated that when the total equity market capitalization is below 80%, it's potentially a great time to own securities. And when it gets higher than the economy as a whole, which would suggest maybe 100%, things may be getting a little heated. So today we're at 140%. We have European interest rates are negative, which I can't even fathom a rational mind buying a guaranteed loss product. So it's very strange to see negative interest rates. And of course, there's now some high yield index indices. A friend of mine, Ben Claremont, who actually works at Coast Street Capital, brought to my attention recently, there's this high yield index in the EU that's now offering 2.5%. And I checked in 2009, they were actually yielding 25%. I'm surprised to see things like Argentina being able to issue 100-year bonds and that the 100-year bonds pay 7%. I think a lot of people are surprised by that. But, you know, we have 8 defaults in Argentina over the last 200 years, and 100-year bonds are yielding 7%. That suggests extreme risk-taking behavior. We've all recently been watching the cryptocurrency mania that's been happening. I don't know where that will end, but Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, they're up thousands of percent. They're swinging wildly each day. And many believe this to be an extreme bubble. And then despite all of this buildup of different distortions in the market, we have the lowest or one of the very lowest periods of volatility, and certainly the longest sustained lowest volatility period since 1990. We're looking back almost 30 years, and there are only several days for a very short term where we've dipped below the current price of the VIX of 9.6. So I think any of these in isolation may not cause a huge amount of concern, but the fact that they're sort of these unique data points are accumulating are perhaps a good reason to start looking at ways to prepare to thrive during a future bear market. So as we look at all of these items, I think it's important to note also what we don't know. Certainly we don't know macroeconomic forecasting. I think it was Buffett who has the quote regarding forecasts may tell you a lot about the forecaster, but very little about the future. I don't claim to know any major macroeconomic trends that are reliable. So we know that we're not going to forecast what's going to happen 3, 5, or 10 years out. The market timing is also a futile endeavor. And so that becomes a challenge, because although we may anticipate that things have been increasing and maybe on the higher side, I do hold a long portfolio. I believe my individual securities are very undervalued. And so predicting the timing of a large bear market is very difficult. So these are a couple of things that we don't know. Let's at this moment focus on that last bullet point regarding volatility. The VIX here is widely considered to represent fear within the market. The VIX is the implied market volatility for the S&P 500. What I'm showing here is data right from the Chicago Board of Exchange. You can pull it there. It goes back to 1990. And it shows that at prices now, which are in the low nines, or 9.5, we are actually hitting the lowest period that we've been in nearly 30 years. Volatility is very inexpensive. And one thing to note in addition is that the risks, as I pointed out in the previous slide, seem to be building and accumulating. So as the risks seem to be growing, we're sitting here in the lowest volatility or people are the most fearless that they've been in almost 30 years. And that seems a little contradictory to me. Another point to mention, while I was working at Diamond years ago, my primary client was Goldman. And I spent many years working with risk management teams at Goldman Sachs in New York and in the UK. And when we were analyzing a bunch of different models for various regulatory agencies and analyzing some different aspects. We were looking at volatility quite closely, and we were analyzing not only volatility, but the volatility of volatility. And you can see here pretty quickly that the volatility of volatility is very high. So the fact that we have low volatility and a sustained low volatility means we're in a really rare period of time, where if you can find an instrument that's priced based on volatility, you're going to find a very uniquely underpriced security, because volatility won't stay this low indefinitely. We are not in some, you know, new, this time is no different. Volatility will at some point increase again. So I think it's very wise to take advantage of these types of opportunities while they exist. I'll also point out here, you know, for many years, part of the reason that this has become so apparent to me is that for many years, I've been writing cash secured puts on high volatile individual equities as a tool to purchase undervalued shares in the marketplace. So receiving a premium and then using cash to purchase the equities. So basically using combination of products to pay less than market price for the security. Today, I see that volatility is so low, especially on a macro S&P 500 level, and the prices are sufficiently high that you can't get a sufficient premium for the risk you're taking if you're willing to sell those puts. And so by inverting that question and asking yourself, well, if the premium has become so low, maybe it starts to become a good time to look at purchasing those securities instead. So what I'd like to do is just point out really quickly that one of the key models that would incorporate volatility is going to be your Black-Scholes option pricing model. You can take a look at the variables here, but at the highest level, what I want to point out is that when you have high asset prices and really low volatility, those two are impact the price of option, both calls and puts, very much. And if you're looking at ways to take advantage of a very low vol, high asset situation, you can certainly look here to the options market to see where you could find some opportunities. So what I'm going to do is quickly bring us into the actual investment opportunity, because then I think we'll be able to discuss the specifics. All right, so how can we build an inexpensive, undervalued hedge in a high equity price, low volatility environment? I think the first thing that many people would consider, and the first thing that we could do, is you could simply buy a put. Volatility is very low, prices are high, and so puts have become cheap. If you looked at similar put prices in 2009, 2010, 2011, they would be extremely expensive. The price of the protection is very high when everyone thinks they need it and very low when people don't think they need it. However, I would argue, as I pointed out in the earlier slides, there are sufficient risks outstanding that it may be prudent to start putting on some protective sort of trades to thrive through a bear market. So first of all, a simple put is an inexpensive option in today's market to hedge your portfolio. But next, if you kind of start thinking second level thoughts, you will recognize that as a value investor, at a certain price in a decline, you can sell or write one or two additional put contracts much further out of the money and bring in those premiums, because at that level, you're happy to be a net buyer and you can take in those premiums and use them to further reduce the cost of this opportunity. And I think actually it's important to note that this is one example. I was actually speaking with a good friend of mine, Mike Lee, who runs Hypotenuse Capital. And we have gone back and forth on many scenarios that are very similar to this. And we've designed things slightly different for each of our portfolios. Some things work will work better in different situations. So this is a single example, but if anybody wants to implement this, they can obviously adjust the variables. They could have different strike prices. They could have different purchase and sell prices. They could even have different expiration dates. I'll point out here one common thought, which is, why are we looking at the S&P 500 specifically? Why the SPY? I actually looked at quite a few different opportunities. One reason that I settled on the S&P 500 is because the S&P 500 has the longest duration contracts. We can actually go out today into January of 2020. And by August of 2018, we will have contracts that go out to 2021. So one of the big risks is timing the market and then missing the opportunity, because of course these contracts expire and they will expire worthless if there hasn't been an adequate correction. So ideally we get the longest coverage we possibly can, and going out 2+ years with a contract to me is sufficient and adequate. If we move to some less liquid indices, oftentimes that duration shrinks. However, there are a number of other situations that may be appropriate for different portfolios. Some people might want to look at a bond ETF. Others might want to view some sort of a leveraged ETF where you could buy these contracts. So again, this is one model, and those who learn and want to implement something of this nature can substitute different variables as they like. So let's take a look at this simple model and look at the payout structure of this hedge. What we have here is the three different legs to this trade. Again, we are buying a put, an out of the money put, and we are selling two further out of the money puts. Let's take a look here at what is taking place. Leg one right at the top shows we're going to buy a put at a strike of 240. Now remember, the S&P 500 is approaching 2,700. The SPY price is, you know, a tenth of that. So it's 270 today. And to use round numbers, let's say we want to have a strike of 240 and we're going to buy a put at that price. Okay, so as the market declines below 240, this leg will become profitable. The price of that trade today, the price of that contract today is $13. And it's 11% below the current market price. Now, I think it's also important to point out, I have a strong, long relationship with my partners. And over the years, I have shown them that we actually anticipate a little bit of volatility. We're willing to accept a little bit of volatility for the long-term compounding to be as efficient as possible and to maximize the long-term compounding. So I'm actually not hedging every single 100 basis point decline in the market. I'm willing to accept that we may have a slight correction that we're not really hedged for. That doesn't really bother me. I think that our positions are sufficiently independent that they will perform well regardless of what the broader market does. However, larger swings, larger bear markets where we see the 25, 30, 35% crashes are of some concern. And I do want to protect the portfolio against major macroeconomic events. So we've moved this out of the money by 11% because it decreases the cost significantly. And so what we've said is leg one, buy the put with a strike of 240. Leg two, sell a put 31% out of the money with a strike of 185. The price of that contract today is about $6. So by selling, that means you bring in $6 in premium. And then the third leg is to sell a third contract with a strike of $160. The price today is roughly $3 per share. That's a 40% decline from the current market price of 270. And again, you would bring in that premium of $3. So if you do this combination of all three legs, you will find that the entire trade costs you $4. So again, you could just buy a put. That put will cost you $13. And that's I look at puts today, protective puts in this nature, to be undervalued. I think that is a fair price to pay. However, you can, if you recognize that at a certain amount decline, you would be a net buyer, you can substantially reduce the cost of this trade from 13 down to 4 in this manner. Let's look here at the next level of this table. I'll just walk through it for clarification. Up top, we have the SPY price. So this is a range from 120 to 300. Keep in mind, we're at 270 today. It then shows the index return based on that 270 price. So at 270, we have a 0% return. And as it goes up, the index is positive. And as it comes down to 120, the market would basically just crash 56%. Okay. The payouts then, leg 1, 2, and 3, show what the payout would be for each of these individual legs at that particular SPY price. And you can see with leg 1, for example, it gets represented in the graph by the blue line. So when you buy the put above that price of 240, above that strike price, you've paid $13. And that's where on the right side of the graph, you see a flat line, and the holder of that put, if the price is there, will have lost $13. As we move to the left side, that put receives its payout. And so that increases in a fairly linear fashion to the left. Ultimately, we have leg 1, 2, and 3 represented in this model. And then the green curve represents the total payout. And this basically shows that at the higher levels, this hedge will actually expire worthless. And so that's where, when we get to position sizing, it becomes a very important consideration. But during a crisis, this inexpensive and asymmetric hedge has the ability to provide a 10 to 12x gain if the S&P 500 declines sufficiently. For example, in here, between 28 and 45%. Additionally, on a wider level, you get a positive multi-bagger gain if it declines anywhere from 15 to 60%. So there is a very wide range where this becomes a positive payout situation if the markets are in decline. And when volatility is higher, you won't be able to get the same payout with this same product. So now that we sort of talked through the actual trade, let's just quickly review for some of the folks out there what's actually happening with these put contracts. So on the top here, here's a payoff illustration for a long put. So remember, when you're buying a put, you're basically buying protection to securities. So if you're buying a long put on the market, you're going to profit when the market declines. So there's really two outcomes. Either the market price is going to be below the strike price, which is indicated by an X. And if that occurs, your profit is essentially going to be the difference between the market and the strike price, or the market price is going to be above your strike price and the contract's going to expire worthless. So a quick illustration, if you bought a security or you bought a put on a security with a strike of 100, if the price falls to 80, your profit would be $20, 100 minus 80. And, you know, obviously you need to adjust for the premium that you paid for that, but it's basically at a simple level, your profit is about 20. If the contract expires with the price of your security above the strike price, so say 110, and your strike price is 100, the contract expires at zero. So you will lose whatever you paid for that contract. Okay, on the bottom half, the short put is the exact opposite. So when you write a put, let's say at that same price, 100, and the market price falls below that 100, your counterpart has the right to put that security to you. So in the case of the SPY, what you're doing when you're writing a put is you're guaranteeing that your willingness to purchase the SPY at that future price. So for a real example, we sold a put at 185. That means if the market declines from today's price of 270 below 185, which is a 30% decline, we are committing to pay $1.85 for shares in the market. Okay, if it falls down to $1.50, that would result in us holding the market, and we would have essentially a short-term loss between $185 and $150. Of course, at that point, we would probably move into sort of second stage of this process, and we may just hold that security for some time, despite maybe the world being volatile again. It's probably, although uncomfortable, it's quite possibly a very good time to be buyers of even the larger market. Okay, obviously then, if back to the short put example, if the price of the market remains above the strike price, you will keep the premium that was paid for the contract, and you have no obligation to buy any security. Okay, so that is just a review of these put payout models. Now, let's compare this with reality. So in slide 10 here, what I've done is I've pulled data since 1980. So this is 37 years of data. I think it's a fairly good sample size. You can go back and look further if you'd like. At a high level, we just see here that there's been a lot of intra-year drawdowns, and four of the times we've seen them exceed 30%. In 2008, we saw a loss that was greater than 35%. So the blue lines on the graph are representing the S&P 500's annual return. And then the red dots represent the maximum intra-year drawdown that occurred. And so, you know, we can look through here and easily see what happened. You know, in the early 80s, there was a recession. You know, we had Black Monday in 87, where we see a major drawdown that occurred. We see there was a dot-com crash in there, and we had the Great Recession in there. We see there are, I think this is a good set of data points to look at as a reference. I don't personally expect the future to mirror the past, but it does rhyme. We see, just by looking at this, drawdowns of 15% or more are quite common. They've occurred in about a third of the years. And we also see that drawdowns of 30% plus happen fairly regularly. There's four occurrences in this time frame. This sort of data set can help us think a little bit about how we would size this position. So let's take a look at how we might think about what size an inexpensive hedge could have in our portfolio. First of all, remember that if markets don't decline, this position's going to zero. We have to hedge it appropriately. We have to size it appropriately. And we have to understand that there are probabilistic outcomes that occur for all of our positions. So again, we talked about so position sizing has major return implications. And one of the most objective frameworks I've found over the years that I think is extremely useful is the Kelly criterion. And the Kelly criterion basically tells you that if you know the probability of success and you know the outcome if you're successful, and then you know the probability of failure, and you know the outcome if you fail, and you have a fixed pool of capital that you're looking to allocate, there's an objective amount that you should allocate to any given opportunity. The challenge in finance is that we really don't know the true probability of something being successful or not. And so what I've done is I've actually inverted that problem a little bit. And I've tried to calculate based on a number of different probabilities what might be the best allocation. And so let's look at a few things here. In the observations, I point out, you know, we've had some major drawdowns, 30% or more in 4 out of 37 years. We've had drawdowns of 15% or more in 13 of the last 37 years. And then I looked through during dot-com crisis and I said, you know, if we have basically all of the total declines in the market coupled with the final major drawdown in the market, we can actually get pretty close to 50% declines in the S&P 500. That may or may not be a once in a lifetime kind of event, but I think we need to plan for things that we don't expect to happen very often. So the assumption here is that we can repeat this opportunity and make this trade continuously if the volatility remains low. So, and by the way, we really only are taking advantage of this opportunity because the volatility is so low. I've tried to use really wide assumptions, and given we are pretty high, you know, things have moved up in a relatively strong manner. We've been in a clear bull market since 2009, and we see a number of increasing risks, as I've pointed out at the beginning. I think that it's reasonable to look at a bear market over the next 5 years, and certainly we should expect something in the next 10 years. It's just factual that markets are cyclical. We will have corrections, we will have downturns, and we should be prepared for them. I think that is a very wide assumption to think it would take 5 to 10 years, but that would mean perhaps that there's a 1 in 10 to 1 in 5 chance that we have a major correction over the next few years. So if you run these kind of really wide assumptions through the Kelly formula and look at what sort of allocation you might make to this trade, it suggests about a 6% portfolio allocation. And that's really aggressive. Kelly is very aggressive. Kelly would suggest that the optimal diversification in a portfolio is between sort of 3 and 10 positions. Kelly is very, very aggressive and gives no consideration to how volatile that portfolio will be. Many people apply half Kelly. So that would be about 3% for this allocation. Now, the way I've looked at this is I've said, well, we're looking and building out a multi-year strategy. So the contracts that we're buying today and that we were buying in mid-2017 actually go out to the end of 2019 and into 2020. So we can get further than 2 years. I'd love to get into a 3-year range with these contracts. And so the way I've approached this is by allocating 100 bips of the portfolio on an annual basis into this undervalued position so that over 3 years, I build up to a 300 basis point allocation. Now, if in some time near the end of 2019, we end up with a 30% decline or decline that brings us to a point where we're earning sort of 12x multi-bagger return on this position, we will see 3% allocation returning, you know, 36 or more percent to the entire portfolio. So the risk reward here is very asymmetric. However, again, I will point out that if there is not a decline, this allocation will, of course, be a weight on the portfolio as it will asymptotically approach zero as it goes to expiration. So with that, I will quickly look at some of the, or I will identify just a few of the risks and considerations. Again, here, the position is going to lose 100% if the SPY doesn't decline 15% before January 2020, which is why position sizing is so imperative. Remember that declines of 30% or more in this specific trade will result in the required purchase of the SPY index fund. And then, of course, if things go to, you know, 8 sigma situations and the SPY is suddenly down 60% or further, there are negative return implications. They will very likely be short-term negative return implications. But nonetheless, you could end up with a scenario where your position is no longer positive. With that, that's basically the end of the presentation slides, and I can open it up to any questions.
Matthew, thank you for sharing such a unique and thought-provoking idea and a broader perspective of how you see the world. This is really eye-opening. I'd love to please turn back to slide 5. If we apply the logic and reasoning that you've shared in a slightly different context, might it be reasonable to conclude that if someone is looking at a large public stock, perhaps looking at the LEAPS would be an interesting opportunity set?
Yeah, Shai, I think that's a very good question. I'm going to approach the answer here in a slightly different manner. And if I don't answer your question directly, feel free to push me a little harder. I want to point out that if somebody is interested in a large liquid security to own as a long position, actually, they probably won't be buying puts on that particular equity. They may, in fact, if volatility has a little bump or there's sufficient premium, they may be selling puts on that security as a tool to buy that or have a counterpart put that into their portfolio. But I'm not sure that they would be buying puts on that particular security. I do think, however, that there is a potential for somebody who is a specialist in analyzing shorts to create a basket of short securities that have liquid securities, that have liquid option markets. And those shorts might actually decline much more than the overall market. So I actually considered putting together a basket of potential shorts. The challenge is that I think I may be overconfident in my ability to select shorts. I don't have any short positions in my portfolio, and I don't have any sort of track record that's measurable that would suggest that I am able to identify shorts. And ultimately, when I'm building out this position, what I'm looking for my own purposes, is something that will definitely help me offset a decline in a broader market. And it would be extremely unfortunate if I chose the wrong securities in that basket of potential shorts and had some of them maybe, and perhaps some of them did not act in the way I anticipated, and thus the hedge failed when it was necessary. But other than that, other than my potential inability to select the shorts, I think that it's a very reasonable opportunity for somebody who has that skill set to build out a basket. And I think if somebody's looking at a large potential position that they want to own, they may consider selling a put to move in. But keep in mind, with this low volatility today, the premiums have come down significantly. Volatility is localized, so every individual security will have its own vega and volatility associated with it. So you could have a high volatility equity, even though the market has low volatility, and that particular premium might be high. That is how I sort of look at individual securities versus the larger market. Did that answer your question, Shai?
I think I might be asking a very general question when the answer is going to be case specific. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, from a very naive and simplistic perspective, perhaps in 2018, spending time on looking at warrants and looking at leaps might be a fertile hunting ground based on the slide you're showing. Or is that?
I absolutely think that's the case, Shai. I think that with so many incredible minds in the community, there's a few people out there that probably have found some really exceptional opportunities in that space. Volatility is rarely this slow, and we've had sustained volatility to the point that my fear is that people have become accustomed to a fearless environment. And because of that, protection is really cheap. And so at the same time, if you were to find a very low vol situation and it was extremely underpriced, maybe you would think about buying a call or a warrant on that particular asset. But yes, Shai, I do think there are some bargains to be found in this space.
If we could please jump to slide number 11. If I could play devil's advocate, not necessarily because I believe this, but just to create the conversation, how do you handicap the possibility that we're not seeing a cyclical dynamic, we're seeing a structural change? And every crisis is different, so every crisis will not repeat the same way and not have the same frequency. And ultimately, the rear view is not overly relevant. How do you respond to that type of critique?
Shai, absolutely. That's a totally fine question. First of all, I tend to shy away from the "this time is different" philosophy. I think that history does rhyme, although that's an inadequate answer to the question for a truly changing paradigm. I think the most critical aspect of this is the position sizing itself. I know a few funds that have been quite bearish for a number of years, have put on extensive hedges, and it has eroded their capital base because we have continued to see markets climb. And the challenge, of course, is the timing aspect. And that is why I am keeping this type of position relatively small. It is at 100 bips. It is not sufficiently damaging to the rest of the portfolio. And it makes me sleep very well at night, knowing we have this asymmetric movement that will come into the portfolio if there is a big decline. So I think the question is a fine one. And I think the answer is in the position sizing of something like this. This should not be a 10 or 20% position in your portfolio. This should be a small position that provides great benefits at times of, you know, a severe crisis.
And Matthew, hearing you speak, it's very clear that you have some domain expertise and you've also given this topic quite a bit of thought. With that background, I'd like to ask, have you explored other ways to express this opinion? And after doing some analysis, you chose not to move forward in these other possibilities, possibly to help save some people some time before they reach a dead end. What other channels have you explored and you chose not to pursue?
I can talk briefly about a few of those, although some of them, it may be that they are worth the pursuit and I may pursue them again. I have considered applying this structure to some leveraged asset classes. So there is the SPY SSO index, which is the double leveraged index. And I spent some time talking with Chicago Board of Exchange and a few other firms about how this might react. And what I've learned is that a lot of the leveraged ETFs work most of the time, even the majority of the time. But the problem with them is that when you get into the extreme situations, which is when we need this to work, a lot of them start to break down. And so it becomes a lot less predictable. It becomes almost dependent on whether you're having consistent days that are dropping, or if the days are oscillating between gains and losses, and so I ultimately moved away from using any of the double levered ETFs. I also, as I mentioned before, considered identifying a basket of shorts. I thought initially that sounded like a very reasonable idea. I could select 20 short opportunities, build out a little basket, and basically buy a put on those securities. However, my concern was, of course, that if they didn't move in the way that I expected, my true concern is that I might be introducing an additional risk into my portfolio rather than reducing risk, because there could be a different outcome that I didn't foresee. I might be introducing additional unknown unknowns. And so I then moved away from creating that basket of shorts. There's a lot of long short funds out there, and a long short fund manager might find buying, if they have really low vol on highly priced short opportunities, they might find that building out something of this nature, it really works for their portfolio. So again, it's something perhaps worth exploring, but I moved away from that. Another thing to consider is, I think, you know, I've started implementing this into my portfolio, but as I've shown here, this is an ongoing trade. And so it's something that I'm doing with several BIPs at a time. And I believe over time, it will become possible to almost diversify the trade a little bit. Perhaps it doesn't need to be on the S&P 500 every year, or maybe it can be split between some bond indices and the S&P 500. But ultimately, there are a number of opportunities. The one I have moved away from is specifically some of the levered ETFs, because I found that they're not necessarily going to match the S&P 500 when it starts moving.
And if we could please move back to your very first slide with your contact details. I'm noticing that you have your contact details here. What type of feedback do you most welcome, and what would be a value add to receive from the audience?
I would welcome feedback. I will point out, this is actually an MOI exclusive. This is the first time I've ever presented this idea to a larger audience. And as I mentioned, I have a very rational LP base that is willing to accept a little volatility for strong long-term performance. However, if there are insights that people in this audience have, I would be more than happy to discuss those. I believe I'm very open-minded, and I would love to hear other great ideas that folks have regarding trade of this nature or an opportunity of this nature. If I've missed something incredibly glaring, I'm happy to hear people's views. If anybody else wants to exchange ideas, happy to hear that as well. Any feedback is welcome, Shai. I'm happy to talk with others.
And just to clarify, what is the best means to get in touch with you? What's your preferred channel?
You know, probably an email is most appropriate. But if somebody wants to give me a call, that's fine as well.
Matthew, with that said, we really appreciate your intellectual generosity. It is always an honor to learn from you. And we appreciate that you chose to be here with us and share your wisdom with us. Thank you very much for such an insightful presentation. We hope to welcome you back in the future. Have a great day.
Thank you, Shai.